From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College.
This is.
This is.
This is.
This is War News Radio.
This is Bobby Zip.
And I'm Megan Curry.
And we are two students at Swarthmore College in Swarthmore, Pennsylvania. You're listening to a two-part series that explores a recent tide of activism and protests addressing racial and educational inequality in South Africa. Throughout this series, you'll hear four South Africans who attended the University of Cape Town speak about their experiences, hopes, and concerns with South Africa today. In the first episode of our series, we will trace the history of educational inequity in South Africa and explore the impacts of the protest movements #RoadsMustFall and #FeesMustFall.
At the intersection of mind and intuition, the Black imagination transcends spatial temporal understanding. It is not past, present, nor future. The Black imagination is saying, I am and I exist outside of spatial temporal understanding.
The Black imagination is omnipotent, all present, alive but constricted by colonized cages, columns, and pages. We are here to tear and tear with no fear, to rip apart these frames and pages with the fury of Black rages. Unleashed, the Black imagination.
You've just heard activists from the Roads Must Fall movement reading a poem called The Black Imagination. The clip was originally posted on SoundCloud in 2016 and is representative of the voices of student activists involved in one of the most inflammatory and powerful higher education campaigns in recent South African history. The rising tide of activism in the nation has sparked major protests and walkouts at South African institutions that frequently turn violent. Instability has closed some higher education institutions for weeks on end, or even indefinitely, disrupting the studies of thousands of college students across the country. In many respects, these movements are either directly or indirectly in response to governmental initiatives designed to reconfigure higher education in South Africa since the end of apartheid in the mid-1990s. Despite the various policy agendas implemented to rectify it, these protests clearly show that the effects of policies institutionalizing inequality in South Africa are far from resolved. Brian Kamanzi is a Cape Town-based writer and electrical engineering master's student at the University of Cape Town. He has witnessed the protests from their beginning and has a lot to say about the movement.
And a lot of the critique there is about individuals. Everything happens at an individual basis, but what about the structural issues? What about the structural apartheid, the structural colonialism? How does one forgive or repair that? And the inability for processes like that to deal with collectivism and collective memory, collective trauma, is precisely what precipitated that kind of organizing form.
This collective trauma that Brian speaks about can be traced as far back as the colonial period and post-colonial instability that followed. Originally a Dutch and then British colony, South Africa gained independence in 1910. The white supremacist Afrikaner National Party gained power in 1948 after years of political instability that was fueled by World War II. Apartheid, which is Afrikaans for apartness, was the political platform of the National Party. From 1948 to 1994, apartheid-inspired legislation that separated South Africans based on race in schools and treated non-white individuals unequally.
South Africa has a long history of student activism as a result of these oppressive laws under apartheid. The Soweto protest of 1976 was one of the most significant in the country's history. The uprisings began after the wake of apartheid legislation that called for the introduction of Afrikaans and English as languages of instruction in Black schools. Over 20,000 students walked out of school to rally against the unilateral movement of the white minority government in the largest student protest. Protesters faced fierce police repression and years of uprisings followed. In 1994, the nation held its first democratic elections and Nelson Mandela was sworn in as the first president of South Africa. Apartheid was dissolved and a new constitution was accepted in 1995. The marginalized population had huge hopes that the new government would empower and equalize colored and black students so they had equal opportunities to the white population. And so, South African history entered the post-apartheid era.
The wave of post-apartheid higher education reforms mirrored the broader political transformation that occurred nationally under the leadership of Mandela. Through a series of legislation backed up by research reports, South African lawmakers created a single national higher education administration. By the mid-2000s, most historically white and historically colored universities were either paired up or restructured. But here's the catch. While universities were technically merged together, the new laws did not require administrators to equalize the quality of education between the formerly separate schools. This begs the question, if a black South African and a white South African technically attend the same institution, shouldn't they receive equal education? The increasing frequency and intensity of protests at these newly merged institutions over the last decade clearly says otherwise.
In 2015, major protests broke out at the University of Cape Town, which is often referred to as UCT. The university was founded in 1829 as a white institution, and to this day, most students are white. The protests started when a student named Chimani Maxwelly rallied for administrators to remove a statue of Cecil Rhodes, which stood on the steps of the Jameson Plaza at UCT. Rhodes was the founder and financier of the British South Africa Company, and over the course of his life, he added territory roughly half the size of Europe to the British Empire. To many of the protesters, Rhodes' statue served as a constant reminder of the violence of South Africa's colonial history. United under the banner of hashtag Rhodes Must Fall, these protests had a serious impact on the day-to-day operations of UCT. Lindiwe, an international student at UCT from Zimbabwe, recounts her experience for us.
I have to say at UCT, I think the media makes it sound way worse than it was. I mean, there were people that got hurt, but it was no way as near as the protests from pre-independence days. It wasn't like that. The worst that happened were rubber bullets. That sounded very, very real. And that is scary because I would hear them from my room. And before you are told that they're rubber bullets, it's very scary.
It's pretty clear that these protests were far from peaceful, but no one in the movement said it would be peaceful. For UCT students, these moments can be shocking, jarring, or even traumatizing. Behind the awe of these moments lie tensions, which Brian says have long been brewing.
What happened in 2015 with the rise of the Rhodes Must Fall movement in particular must be understood as sort of like a combination of little things that happened that eventually spilled over into something much larger. There were a lot of conversations about the unfulfilled promises of so-called democracy, but also about non-racialism and the Mandela's project for South Africa, or what has been framed as Mandela's project for South Africa.
The Rhodes Must Fall movement was not organized as a solidified body, but was a broader unification of marginalized groups on the university campuses coming together to oppose the residual presence of apartheid on campus. The free flow of these groups empowered them because they were not easily targeted by the university or higher bodies of power.
The Rhodes Must Fall movement, when it started, were meant to be pan-Africanism, black consciousness, and black radical feminism. And that I think, is the, in broad terms, a reasonable descriptor of who was in the room at the time.
Black consciousness is a grassroots movement that originated in the 1970s under the anti-apartheid leader Steve Biko. Because of the ideological structure of Rhodes Must Fall and its focus on black empowerment, those involved were adamant that white people have a limited role in the movement. There was a notable lack of white presence on the ground, but as Brian explains, this was a very purposeful decision made by the movement itself.
In terms of organizing decisions and who were the groups that were allowed to participate in making decisions, a decision was taken that white students and white people could not be part of that. They could be part of the popular education spaces and part of the popular protest, but could not form part of the conversations around the decision making about what is to be done for the movement.
In February 2016, Rhodes Must Fall activists at UCT erected a large shack at the bottom of the bustling Jameson staircase. The shack symbolized racially segregated, densely populated, and impoverished areas, formerly known as townships during apartheid. This became known as the Shackville occupation and aimed to draw attention to the housing inequities between Black and white students. Rent prices in Cape Town are incredibly high, and like most other universities, UCT offers residential housing or dorms at a much cheaper rate. Students from all over South Africa arrived, only to be told the campus residences were overbooked. While many white students secured residence by themselves or through connections, a number of Black students had no choice but to sleep on benches around campus. This eruption of student homelessness contributed to the energy of a parallel movement to Roads Must Fall that was emerging.
In October 2015, thousands of students took to the streets in a fight for free and decolonized higher education. The initial protests emerged in response to an announcement that universities nationwide would be raising tuition fees by up to 10% in the following year. Protesting students faced harsh backlash. Many were subject to arrest, as well as disciplinary academic action.
Fees Must Fall was understood to be, like, in a way, kind of similar to what was happening with Black Lives Matter. It was essentially a hashtag under which people were making a common cause with each other. But it was not coordinated in any kind of structural way. There were people who knew each other on different campuses, but at that time, it wasn't an organization, and it still isn't an organization.
A critical piece to this movement was the media activism and harnessing the power of many different social platforms across the country. Brian talks briefly about how critical social media platforms were to organizing and amplifying the movement.
So I think we were challenging on all fronts the perceptions around the campaign and the central debates, and so much of the movement actually took place online.
On August 12th of the following year, the Council on Higher Education declared that a continuation of the tuition freeze was unsustainable. Minister for Higher Education, Blades Amandi, cautioned that anything short of a 6% increase would drive the public higher education system into collapse. President Zuma instructed his finance ministers to find the money, however possible. Critics widely note that the government spends only 0.75% of GDP on tertiary education, which is less than the average in Africa, the world, and far below the average in developed countries. Still, the government announced last September that universities would be allowed to increase their fees in 2017, but by no more than 8%. The South African police services have responded forcefully to the protests, perceiving them as violent and destructive. Students have been arrested for alleged vandalism, such as the burning of buildings, destruction of oppressive colonial paintings, and throwing feces at a campus statue. Aside from the fact that these movements weren't nonviolent, the police response is unwarranted on multiple levels and contributed to an environment that was not conducive for students to go out to classes.
No, there were a couple of people that got hurt, but I think it gave rise to a lot of mental illness or psychological suffering. I did not, like, personally physically take part in the protests or march or anything, but it was very hard mentally to, like, deal with everything, especially as an international student, because you want to support the cause, but at the same time, your permit is about to expire, and if you don't write the exams when they were set, what are you going to do when your visa is expired?
As Lindy Way points out, the protests have impacted many students who do not identify as parts of the movement. Instability on campus affects everyone and every faculty. Layla Khan, a law student, describes similar difficulties in maintaining the balance between scholar and activist.
And I also have to get my degree. Like, I also am trying to, like, get my family, you know, out of poverty. I'm trying to do all of these things. So definitely, like, that's another risk. Because you also not only are facing, like, security, like, issues of private security and police, you're also facing internal disciplinary measures, right? And then I think there's also, like, much more of a risk if you're at a historically Black institution versus, like, a predominantly white institution that UCT is. So there's a lot more media coverage at UCT, so there's a lot less willingness for police to be violent, but they are anyway. For instance, the Shackville burning of the paintings, like, that was, like, went on and on of, like, the media talking about how it was so violent and how can you, like, destroy our heritage. Firstly, so it's, like, not heritage. It's not the heritage of the majority of South Africans. It's also another form of violence, right? So it's a kind of violence that's exacted upon, like, people of color when you have to see, like, colonizers and oppressors like staring at you every single day. That's another form of psychological violence. Like, it's another form of also epistemic violence when you're seeing that, that is seen as heritage and your heritage is like not there at all.
Despite the psychological strains and disruption to classes that protesters have caused over the past few years, students have used universities as a platform to exercise remarkable creativity, as a way to empower the movement and its messages. Protesters have used different forms of visual art, music, and media productions to spread their messages. While skeptics of the movement argue that students should focus their attention towards the government rather than university campuses, these places offer a level of protection that stops the movements from getting shut down by police or governmental forces. As the situation continues to destabilize, the future of these movements and higher education in South Africa hang in the balance. Join us for the next installment of When Things Fall Apart, where we'll be discussing media activism and the structural inequities of basic education in South Africa.